From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Frank Stella is considered one of the fathers of minimalist art. On today's Fresh Air, Stella talks about his work, from his black paintings of the late 50s to the large, wildly colored metal sculptures he's making today. Also, more than 16,000 secret documents have been declassified pertaining to Chile, the U.S. role in overthrowing President Salvador Allende and supporting the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. We talk with Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive, which helped lead the campaign to declassify the documents. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Chad Pergram. The Florida Supreme Court has given the go-ahead for Palm Beach County to conduct a manual recount of presidential ballots. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
Palm Beach County's hand recount had been in legal limbo for 4 days, but today Florida's high court ruled that there is no legal impediment to a hand recount. Election workers will count until midnight tonight and start up again in the morning until the more than 462,000 votes are counted. However, Florida's Republican Secretary of State, Catherine Harris, has said she will not accept any further counts, so the Palm Beach recount will be subject to more litigation. It's also not clear how election officials will resolve the issue of disputed or partially punched ballots. Republican voters here today protested any hand recount, calling it subjective and unfair. In a demonstration coordinated by the Republican Party, voters shouted, "Sore loser Gore," and "No more Chads." Eric Westervelt, NPR News, West Palm Beach.
Gore's campaign chairman, William Daley, applauded the Supreme Court ruling.
"We think it is particularly significant that the Florida Supreme Court sent a clear signal to the counties that their counts can continue, notwithstanding the secretary's efforts to terminate those counts 3 times in the past 3 days."
Daley said he hoped the counties would complete the recounts expeditiously. Bush attorney James Baker decried the decision and said the Gore campaign was spinning its meaning.
"A one-paragraph interim order of the Florida Supreme Court has just been portrayed to you by my good friend Secretary Daley as the biggest thing since night baseball."
Baker says the ruling is not a decision on the merits, but it preserves the status quo. The Bush campaign says it will not seek a recount in Iowa. From member station WOI, Joyce Russell reports.
Vice President Gore's still unofficial lead in Iowa is a narrow 0.3%, and some in the Bush campaign envisioned potential recounts in 4 states with close margins as a backup to winning Florida. But Iowa spokesman Eric Wilson said the Bush campaign expects a final result in Florida this weekend.
"That, I think, sends a pretty clear message that Wisconsin and New Mexico and Iowa and Oregon are out of the mix."
Many Iowa supporters had urged Governor Bush to seek the recount. In a prepared statement, the campaign criticized Gore's recount efforts in Florida and said Bush would instead work to ensure the fairness, accuracy, and finality of the 2000 election. For NPR News, I'm Joyce Russell in Ames, Iowa.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 52 points to close at 10,656 in moderate trading of 939 million shares. Decliners beat advancing issues. The Nasdaq slipped 133 to close at 3032, and the S&P 500 fell by 13. You're listening to news from National Public Radio. The country's first bullet train left Washington today. It carried VIPs north to New York. At times, the train zoomed to speeds of 135 miles per hour. NPR's Jack Spear was on the bullet train and has this report.
Without any major hitches, Amtrak's new Acela high-speed express train rolled out of Washington's Union Station on its maiden run to New York and then on to Boston today. And while the arrival of the first of the sleek bullet trains comes over a year behind schedule, Amtrak has a great deal riding on Acela. When this service begins accepting paying passengers next month, the train should cut about 15 minutes off the Washington to New York trip. It will significantly reduce travel time between New York and Boston. Business class includes blue upholstered seats with fold-down tray tables and power outlets for laptop computers. Amtrak with Acela hopes to compete with the air shuttle and other services that operate along the Northeast. It's hoped Amtrak's Acela could eventually add about $180 million in additional revenues to the rail line. riding the new Acela Express between Washington and New York. Jack Spear, NPR News.
United Airlines has been forced to cancel hundreds of flights over the past couple weeks because of maintenance trouble. The company says its mechanics are taking planes out of service to perform unnecessary repairs, plus the mechanics are refusing to work overtime. The mechanics union says its workers have not organized any job action. The contract with mechanics expired in July. They want raises similar to those given pilots. Stock prices for American Greetings have plummeted 40%. That's forced the company to start an organizational restructuring. The company says the problem stems from people sending more email and fewer cards. I'm Chad Pergram, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is artist Frank Stella. Time magazine art critic Robert Hughes once wrote, "Stella wrings more pictorial feeling from abstract art than anyone else alive." Stella is considered one of the fathers of the minimalist art of the 60s. His early work in the late 50s was a series of black paintings whose austerity contrasted with the bold brushstrokes and drips of abstract expressionism. In the 60s, Stella moved on to geometrical paintings, often in vivid, clashing colors. His work has continued to evolve. Today, many of his paintings and sculptures are on a large scale. In fact, he works out of a foundry for his sculptures. He sometimes uses computer technology to generate images that he incorporates into his work. Stella is also admired for his ideas about art. In the mid-80s, he gave the prestigious Norton Lectures at Harvard University. His new paintings and sculptures are on exhibit in Philadelphia at the Locks Gallery. I asked Stella to describe his new work.
To describe the work that I'm doing right now, I guess, is to describe really the work that I've been working on for the last 10 years. So it's not difficult for me, but I mean, basically, I'm working on painting, sculpture, and architecture, although actually in this show we don't see much of the architectural models. But I've just been working in a fairly broad way, actually making paintings in a kind of sort of flat, almost conventional paintings. And I think the sculpture is really something new, or new for the last decade anyway, and there are small examples of it here. And there's one big example of it, which is it's a sculpture, but it because of the gallery and the way it fits in, it takes on aspects of installation art. Although I hate that word, and I mean I don't hate all of the installation art, but the idea that I've sunk so low as to do an installation seems to me a horrible idea.
Oh, what's so awful about installation?
I don't know. Installations are usually an excuse for things that can't be resolved, or don't even come close to being resolved. The average installation, in my mind, is somebody placing something on the floor.
Are you working on a very large scale now? Even the art that's in the gallery in Philadelphia now is maybe 10 feet high, and one of the sculptures fills a whole room. You work not only in your studio, you have a foundry. You have a staff, you have a crew that you have to work with because the works are so large.
Yeah, people make a lot of that, actually. It's interesting that I have a, I mean, I it's not my foundry. I work at a foundry. I have a studio, and I have people who work with me and help me out. You know, from my point of view, there's a lot of work to do, and we all work at it. I mean, it's not exactly collaboration because, by and large, they're supposed to be doing what I tell them to do. Sometimes they don't, and the results are good, and sometimes they don't, and the results are quite bad. But we've been doing it for a fairly long time. The people who work with me have worked for me for 15 or 20 years. But now it's sort of leveled out, and they're all, ready to go on to their own lives and everything like that. And it's sort of that kind of thing is winding down for me. But maybe that's why this is a sort of a last burst to get some big things done while I both have the energy and have people who can stay focused to work with me.
Now, I'm not an artist, but, you know, I would think that that's something might get lost in the process of not just doing it all yourself, you know, the man alone in his room with his paint and the canvas or with his sculptural material.
You know, I mean, it's sort of ludicrous, actually. I suppose that people can mess things up, but by and large, one man can't do very much. Although Michelangelo did fire some of his assistants when he was working on the Sistine Chapel because they were annoying him, I guess, and he had to finish it himself. On the other hand, I would be more than happy to have Sebastiano del Piombo and Perugino and to have and Polidoro Caravaggio or something, the people that helped, Michelangelo. It wasn't bad, those kind of us.
But has your role as an artist become something you never imagined it would be? Somebody who basically has to run a business and pay a staff and work with a foundry?
You know, it's changed. I mean, and it's just as hard to pay for yourself or take care of your children or whatever you do. On the scale of it doesn't matter somehow all that much to me. I don't know. The one thing that hasn't changed actually is the problem is always the same, to get the work done. That's always hard. Money never made it easier, and now that I don't have so much money, it's still hard. I mean, I don't understand.
You don't understand what?
I don't understand how it came to be that you could be successful and so overwhelmingly unsuccessful at the same time. Yeah.
What's the unsuccessful part?
It's that it's the effort that it takes to make anything.
Right.
And to make, and it doesn't change the amount of effort that it's needed to make something good. In fact, actually, maybe it gets harder.
Frank Stella is my guest, and he has a show of new work at the Lox Gallery in Philadelphia. Your work has changed so much since the late 50s when the public became aware of your work, and you first became known for your black striped paintings, and these were paintings that helped launch the minimalist movement. Then you did color paintings that often used very geometrical forms. And then eventually your work became like wildly colored with drips and brushstrokes, and your work became more sculptural with a lot of like edges, and you started working with hard materials like metal. Do you feel that by starting with all black and then by adding color and then adding more kind of wild elements to it, that you strip things down to a basic vocabulary of yours and then kind of added things to that vocabulary and built things up again?
I suppose. I mean, you can imagine it, I guess, a life story any way you want. I mean, it starts with a lot of youthful enthusiasm and ends with mature wisdom, which is a simplification of everything happens. Or you can start out as a sort of aggressive, hard-nosed, kind of arrogant youth and pare everything down and dare everybody to say that you can't, that you can't get it all before you even know what it's all about.
Did you feel like your early black canvases were a dare?
They were, yes, I think they were. I mean, they were pretty aggressive, yeah. But I mean, I felt very confident about them, yeah.
What were they about to you? What did you see yourself as trying to do or to say?
Well, it was about being able to make an abstract painting that really wasn't based on anything but the gesture of making itself, which was the gesture of making the painting.
What do you mean by that?
So that the gesture of drawing is just it was just the path of the stripe that was the created the painting, or sort of the path of the brush on the canvas.
Go ahead.
Well, it's not most drawing is outline or edging to create a form, and the drawing and the painting in this work was one, and it didn't create a form; it was the form.
What did you think were some of the most interesting on-track and off-track pieces of art criticism about your early work?
Well, I had a hard time with criticism because, I really liked what I did and I was interested in painting and I had a kind of critical attitude towards painting. But the writing about it was really a little bit beyond me. I mean, I was a relatively unsophisticated person in that way. I mean... I really wasn't interested in philosophy or in the notion that you could appeal to smart people by saying smart things about painting. I just wanted to make paintings that I liked. I didn't care if smart people liked them, actually, unfortunately. But and it wasn't, it's hard to make paintings, and I was really interested in the idea of art. And criticism is a little tricky because criticism is worried about so many things. And it hardly ever worries about how good the art is or how hard it is to make art. So it criticism, I'm not criticizing criticism, but it always has to place it within a context. And if you're actually the person who's making the art, there is no context. The context is the immediate moment that you make the painting and the paintings you make. And that's what I That's the only place I live in, or I am. I am there, and that's where I live. And then the other things happen afterwards. But, you know, to me, criticism is like, I don't know, a sport or entertainment or something. It's not, unfortunately, really serious for me.
Artist Frank Stella is my guest. What was the impact on you to become famous and controversial when you're in your 20s and just starting off as a painter?
Actually, the thing about being famous, and never, I wasn't worried about it because the art world was a much smaller place, and I had not much interest in fame. I liked other artists who were famous, and but I really wanted more than anything to make art that was as good as the good artists were making. I wanted to make art that someday, and I didn't expect it to be that way right away, it would be as good as de Kooning or Klein or Newman or Pollock or Rothko. They were my heroes, and I wanted to make art that was as good as that. All I cared about was whether if you put one of my paintings next to a Rothko, it looked okay. That's what I wanted. I don't know what fame is really, but I mean, that was what I was interested in.
When you were in your 20s, in the 1950s, it was a period when some of the very famous artists like Pollock were famous not only for their work, but for their lifestyle. You know, a kind of bohemian lifestyle and a lot of drinking and everything. And some people in their attempt to be artists would emulate the lifestyle as well. Did that lifestyle mean anything to you? Is it?
No, it didn't mean much, largely because I was so young, and it was just very hard to, keep yourself together. I mean, to keep working, to get money, to do whatever you have to do. I mean, I didn't really actually have that much time to get drunk.
My guest is artist Frank Stella. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is artist Frank Stella. He has a new show in Philadelphia at the Lox Gallery. You grew up in, I think, a pretty middle-class family.
Yes.
Father was
yes.
a doctor, a gynecologist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And apparently he worked as a house painter
yes.
during the Depression to put himself through college.
Yes.
And from what I've read, it sounds like occasionally he'd, like, repaint the house you lived
yes.
in and
yes.
you'd help
yes.
him paint.
I was in paint all my life, yes. Yeah.
Did you enjoy the feel of house paint or the colors of
yes,
house paint?
Yes, I did. I liked it. I mean, I always liked paint. The physicality of it, yeah. It was never a problem for me. My mother was an artist, too, and she painted with oil, and my father painted with house paint, so I had paint pretty well covered. When I first saw de Kooning and Klein, say, for example, and even Pollock, I knew right away how it was done. I mean, it wasn't a problem for me about how to make those kind of paintings.
And did you know that more from house paint than anything else?
Yes, yeah. I knew it from painting houses. And, I mean, even at the time that Pollock was doing it, I mean, there's a tradition for decorating and dripping paint on floors and on furniture and stuff. So, I mean, it's been around. I mean, it just hadn't been in the art world.
So what connection did you see between, you know, the house painting and the Pollocks?
Well, I thought, painting a wall is a big physical expanse. You do it, and I could see most of the time that if you stopped halfway through where you were painting your wall, it would be a lot more interesting. But, you know, no one's going to let you stop and sort of have it half white and half red. But it was beautiful, and so I liked doing it, and I could easily see that you could make paintings like that.
How did you get from, you know, painting walls to actually painting canvases?
Well, I mean, I painted all my way through school. I mean, I went to Phillips Academy in Andover, and I took art classes. And then when I was at Princeton, we had art teachers, and I took classes there. And I just, you know, I was around the studios, as it were.
Yet the impression I get from reading interviews with you is that you never studied the technique of representational art.
That's true. When I was at Phillips Academy, you had to. There was an introductory course which consisted to the arts, to fine art, and that consisted of an art history course and a studio course. It was a combination, and so you went to art history lectures, and then you went to the studio and you made paintings. And one of the prerequisites in the painting course, the first thing was a kind of motif. So they had you had to make a painting. Of a still life, you know, there was something set up, and that was a requirement. But and then you went on from there. And somehow, I don't know how it worked, actually. Patrick Morgan, who was a painter, and his wife, Maud Morgan, was a painter, and she showed in New York, and he showed in Boston. They were relatively, at that time, successful painters in the early 50s. That was Pat's idea of the course. You did that, and then you went on to do something else or whatever it was. But they made it, you know, you had to, you couldn't make a mess. You had to sort of paint it in some kind of way. And so I didn't really like it and everything, and we had a class, and they've started showing us about Seurat and neo-impressionism and things like that. And then I said to myself, oh, that's, you know, that's kind of obvious. So I ran downstairs to do my painting, and I just made it all splotches. So I made a table with splotches, a cylinder with splotches, some ivy with splotches, and it all held together. It looked sort of like a painting. And everyone else was doing the modeling and the light and shadow and having a wonderful time doing what they were doing. But I was done. And I showed it to Pat Morgan, and he said, all right, all right. And he let me go. And from there on, I just did whatever I wanted. I didn't have to do any more representational art.
So how much did you actually do before abandoning it?
Well, I did about 20 minutes.
how old were you?
I was probably 15.
And I'm surprised that your teacher just kind of allowed you to dismiss the technique like that.
Look, I was a wise guy, but, you know, a lot of teachers have to deal with kids who are wise guys. I mean, but if you know what you're doing, I mean, it's like, you know, what are you going to do? You're the tennis coach, and the kid comes in and he hits the ball 90, 80, 90 miles an hour, and no matter what you do, he hits it back. You know, you can say, well, that's not exactly the right way to do it, and you can talk to them, but you're not going to tell them to forget it. I mean, you know, either you can hit the ball or you can't.
No, what was it that made you realize that you just weren't about representational art? Was it a technical problem or just like an aesthetic lack of interest?
I had representational art on my window. My mother painted Santa Claus on there, and she was always making paintings. I saw representational art all the time. I wasn't very moved by it, but when I saw magazine reproductions of Franz Klein, and when I saw the Pollock painting and the paintings and the Hans Hofmann paintings in Patrick Morgan's house and in the gallery at the Addison Gallery, I mean, I was overwhelmed by that. I mean, I just loved them, and I wanted to make paintings like that, and I just wasn't going to let anything keep me from making paintings like that right away. I wasn't going to wait, 10 years and then make an abstract painting.
Was there ever a point in your life where you said to yourself, I wish that I had studied representational technique and that I had more of that technique available to me?
I didn't understand representational painting very much, and I probably wouldn't understand representational technique up to a point. But when I, you know, maybe 30 years later, when I saw in the Capitoline Museum Caravaggio, St. John the Baptist, the young St. John the Baptist, it really knocked me out, and I really liked it, and it was very real. And the realist technique, I should have said, oh, my God, but I can't do this, and I should have been very worried about it. But it actually, the effect was the opposite. It was a kind of incredible euphoria about saying, you know, actually, that's it. You know, that's what painting is about. And I realized that Caravaggio's success and what made this painting beautiful, which was its sense of being very real, being very physically present, had to do with the fact, not had actually nothing to do with the technique, but with the fact that Caravaggio worked very hard at painting and that he had wanted to make a painting. And once I realized that, you know, the goal is what counts, what you intend to do, what you want to make, making things pictorial is what's important. The technique you use to make the pictoriality manifest, to make it successful, that doesn't really matter. You know, you get the job done whichever way you can. They never had a problem in the caves in Lascaux or wherever, Altamira. They got the job done.
When you were a student, were you ever afraid that a teacher would think, or fellow students would think, that you were a fraud or something because you had skipped that whole step in the evolution of mastering representational technique?
Well, fortunately, I wasn't a particularly successful student, so all of the other students were more successful or seemed better at it. But I wasn't worried. I mean, the issue of being a fraud, you know, that just never came up because, I mean, I worked, you know, I was in the studio every day. I was there 2 or 3 hours a day. All the other students who were better and had this kind of technique, that I never saw them there. I mean, they came for 1 or 2 hours a week. I was there 9 or 10 hours a week. So, you know, I mean, I know who's there and who's not. You know, it doesn't matter what the technique is. It's what the effort is that goes into making art.
Have you ever been through a period where you felt that you were at an artistic dead end and you knew that a series you were working on or a direction you were exploring was finished and you didn't know where you were heading yet?
Mm-hmm. A couple of times, yeah.
What did you do during that interim where you weren't sure what was next but you knew what you had been doing was finished?
I pretended it wasn't a problem.
Why? Why pretend? Was that for your own benefit or so the people around you wouldn't lose
confidence?
Right,
or for everybody, yes. Yeah, art is a little bit like a performing art. If performers, athletes or singers or performers, whatever it is, if you communicate to those around you or outside of you a lack of confidence, you might just as well be dead. They thrive on your confidence.
So you got to keep that to yourself if there's any doubts.
Yes, it's better, yeah. One thing I learned early on was never to, no matter how bad my painting was, or was never to say anything bad about my own work.
How'd you learn that?
Because you say and make a casual remark to a friend about you don't like this part of your painting, some little trivial thing, and then you know, a couple of weeks later you'll hear it from a museum director that painting is a complete failure.
Well, there's also a real stock market factor in the art, in arts, you know, where like somebody's stock, the actual price of their paintings fluctuates, goes up and down over the course of the career, depending on, I guess, a lot of different variables. Has that been something that's kind of, that you found more amusing or disturbing, that kind of stock market
fluctuation? No, it's just a reality, and it's a struggle. I mean, I've been up and down and up and down, and it's still the same. It hasn't actually really changed very much for me. It's still very hard to keep it all together. You know, I could blame myself, I suppose, you know, if I didn't blow so much money or if I didn't spend so much money making art. But in order to do what I want to do, which is basically make art, it's a struggle to raise the money, really, to pay my own way without a patron. It's quite hard.
Frank Stella will be back in the second half of the show. He has a show of new work in Philadelphia at the Lox Gallery. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with artist Frank Stella. Also, new information on the role of the U.S. government in the 1973 Pinochet coup in Chile. We talk with Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive, which helped lead the effort to declassify thousands of secret documents.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our conversation with artist Frank Stella. He has an exhibition of new work in Philadelphia. One of the commissions that you're working on now is for, you described it as an architectural piece, and this is for the Miami Heat Stadium.
Yeah, it's called the band shell. Yeah, it really is a sculpture that's in the shape of a band shell, and it has a stage, so it could be a performing piece, a piece you could perform on, yes. It's a big outdoor piece.
And you were telling me you're actually building this in France at a foundry that does military work. Do I have that right?
Well, it's a big shipyard in Cherbourg, yeah. And they do things for the French Navy and maybe other navies too, I don't know. But it's a very large shipyard, and it's pretty it's a heavily automated shipyard, and we're building this piece there because we tried to build it with smaller shops here in America, and it didn't work out for a number of reasons, but so we've moved it there. But one of the problems with it is that so much of the effort ends up being about technical factors, and the piece itself is finally overwhelmed by the necessity to be a public artwork outdoors in Miami, and it's a complicated piece. The geometry is complicated, and in order to build a complicated piece that has to withstand the 170-mile-an-hour wind, you're just banging your head against the wall all the time. It's just difficult, to meet all of the criteria that you need to make it stable.
Well, knowing how difficult it is to hire a contractor just to do some work in your bathroom or your kitchen, I can't imagine what it's like to have that much at stake with contractors working at a shipyard.
Well, it's a drag.
Around the world.
Right. I mean, they're supposed to be honest. I mean, but we had a lot of problems with the welding on our piece, and it's a lot of aluminum, a large amount of welding that had to meet specifications that just weren't met here. And so in a smaller yard, maybe where they're not, they're not used to those kind of standards, or they don't really feel it's necessary. You know, everyone says, oh, yeah, but it's really strong enough. But we can't afford to go by that.
I want to, if it's okay with you, ask you about your finger.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, yeah.
You have one finger that...
Yeah, I have a crushed left hand. Yeah, yeah. I have one finger is half, and a couple of the other fingers are damaged. Yeah. It's a crush injury from when I was 10 years old.
What happened?
A concrete urn in the yard was toppled over onto my hand. That's all. It was a crush injury.
And... were the parts of your finger amputated on the spot, or was that
when it's crushed, it turns black. I mean, and eventually they had to cut it off. Yeah, I went to the hospital, yeah.
And you do a lot of physical work. It's never interfered
with it?
Yeah,
but I'm right-handed, so it's not.
And it's your left hand that was crushed. So you're okay with that?
It's not a problem.
And I think, did that get you out of the military?
Actually, indirectly it did, yeah. And I wasn't thinking about it, but... And it was a turning point in my artistic career because when I left school, when I graduated from Princeton, I went to New York and took a loft and started painting. And I wasn't really that aggressive about being a painter or being an artist, but I did it because I had to go in that September to go home to Boston to take a physical examination. We still had for the draft. And I expected to be drafted, so I thought, well, this is just dead time. I'll paint for a while and then go in the Army. And then I'll worry about my career when I get out, after I do my military service. And that really was the only thought that I had. I mean, it wasn't complicated, and I wasn't conflicted or anything. I mean, I was just painting and living in New York with my friends, meeting people and making paintings. And then I went to take my physical examination. And... I didn't really want to go in the Army, so I did all the things. I wet my bed, I sucked my thumb, they just laughed at me, and they stamped all my papers. And then the last guy, there were three doctors in a row on the table, and the guy looked at me and he said, let me see your left hand. And I said, yes, sir. And he picked up an envelope, and he held out the envelope to me. He said, put this between your thumb and your index finger. And I said, yes, sir. Your third finger, your fourth finger, your little finger. And I said, yes, sir. He said, son, you have faulty opposition. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, you don't want to go in the Army, do you? And I said, no, sir, which I think is not exactly what I should have said. And he said, you went to Princeton, didn't you? And I said, yes, sir. He said, I don't think you'd make a very good soldier anyway. And he picked up the other thing and he stamped it and I was out.
How'd you feel?
Well, I felt weird, actually. I mean, I was happy not to be in the Army, and then I suddenly realized that I was going to go back to New York to my studio, that I didn't have a career ahead of me in the Army. They kept telling me my tour of duty would be in West Germany or Korea, and I wasn't sure which fabulous place I wanted to go to, but I had these fantasies of going on tour. I mean, the Army tour is a little bit different than my idea of touring. But anyway, I called up my father, and I said, gee, I'm sorry, Dad, I have bad news. I failed my physical examination. I won't be able to go in the Army. And he said, too bad. It would have made a man of you. And I said, well, I'm just going to go back to my studio. And that was it.
Were there things you had to face in the studio that you didn't feel ready to face yet because you thought you were putting all that off till after your tour of duty?
You know, no, I don't know. I mean, it wasn't a problem. I don't know why. I just went back to my studio and kept on painting. Life at that age, New York was sort of relatively gentle there. I mean, there were artists around, and you could sort of bum around, and it was okay. You could manage.
When you dream, is there ever a kind of visual correlation between the type of work that you're involved with at the moment and the color or the imagery in your dreams?
Not much. I mean, I've had a few dreams about painting, but they're mostly nightmares, actually.
What, anxiety dreams about deadlines?
Yes.
Do you usually feel pretty pressured about things?
Yes, I do. As you get older, I mean, the polite way of saying it is your short-term memory starts to go. And I find myself pretty beleaguered, yeah. I can't handle everything very well.
What, mean memory-wise? Or?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But do the pressures of making art and the pressures of meeting deadlines and the pressures of being able to afford the work that you're doing inhibit you at all? I mean, do they ever interfere with
you? I don't know. I mean, I like to feel that they do. But when I just came down today to see the show at the gallery, you know, I stopped by. You know, I don't see how this show could be I think it's pretty good, and I like it, and I'm satisfied with it in a lot of ways. And it wouldn't be that way if it hadn't been for all of the things that went wrong with it. I mean, all of the pressures and everything. I don't think I could have. Somehow it happens because you work at it and you work your way through it. And you just can't get around that. You can't beat the game.
Is there an example you can give of something that turned out in a way that you're really happy with that resulted from a problem that you can describe, something you had to overcome?
Well, the whole show is a problem because the gallery has those huge four columns downstairs and six columns upstairs. And I had work, and then I just, you know, for a while I thought of putting things in the space, and then finally I gave up around the 10th of August, and I said to Earl Childress, who works with me, and I said, look, I can't face it. I can't do that show there. I said, we just have to face the columns. And then he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, let's use the columns. And then we went from there.
Do a lot of young artists want advice from you?
I don't see too many young artists. They don't. No, I haven't had anyone ask me for advice, actually. I don't think anyone has ever asked me for advice.
how do you keep yourself isolated from that?
I don't know. Maybe I just don't attract the kind of people that need advice, I hope. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, Frank Stella, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Frank Stella has an exhibition of new work in Philadelphia at the Lox Gallery. Coming up, newly declassified documents about American intervention in Chile. This is Fresh Air. This week, as Americans have been focused on our contested presidential election, new information has been released about U.S. interference in another country's democracy, Chile.
16,000 secret U.S. records were declassified and released on Monday, pertaining to U.S. covert operations involved in the overthrow of the democratically elected Chilean president Salvador Allende, the support of the 1973 coup led by Augusto Pinochet, and the bolstering of the 17-year Pinochet dictatorship. This is the fourth and final part of the Clinton administration's Chile declassification project. Peter Kornbluh says it's enabling us to rewrite the history of U.S. intervention in Chile. Kornbluh is a senior analyst at the National Security Archive, which helped lead the declassification campaign. He brought with him a document that reveals one of President Nixon's reasons for wanting the CIA to intervene in Chile.
He says our main concern in Chile is the prospect that Allende can consolidate himself, and the picture projected to the world will be his success. It seems that what the President of the United States was concerned about was that a socialist coalition in Chile would be freely elected, and this would be a model for other countries, not only in Latin America, but in Europe as well, where there were very strong socialist parties, where Euro-communism was an issue, to follow suit. And this is a very important document. We have documents that really, I think, show the leading role of Nixon's then National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger, in overseeing and orchestrating CIA operations to undermine Allende. We have memos from Kissinger to Nixon that lay out what needs to be done. We have the meeting minutes of something called the 40 Committee, which was the committee that decided the policy of covert intervention in Chile, which Kissinger chaired. And in these documents, we can see his absolute leading role in pressing the CIA forward to undermine democracy in Chile.
At one of those meetings, Kissinger says, unless we establish tight control and professional guidance, the covert action program approved by the 40 Committee for Chile will not work. It's going to be a long shot as it is if we have to face the additional handicaps of well-meaning but unprofessional activism, of lack of coordination, and of bureaucratic resistance. We will be dangerously exposed. What's he talking about?
What you're reading is a memo that Henry Kissinger has sent to the President of the United States, imploring him to authorize a kind of a new bureaucratic setup to effectively launch these covert operations, have the CIA intervene in Chilean political affairs, and block Salvador Allende from being inaugurated after he was elected. And Kissinger is taking the lead here to lay out to the president what needs to be done, how the ambassador has to be circumvented, how the CIA has to have a structure, a special task force, and all the resources necessary for this covert project to overthrow democracy in Chile to succeed.
At a National Security Council meeting, President Nixon said in discussing about why he wanted to bring down Allende, he says, no impression should be permitted in Latin America that they can get away with this, that it's safe to go this way. All over the world, it's too much the fashion to kick us around. There must be times when we should and must react, not because we want to hurt them, but to show we can't be kicked around.
This is reminiscent of Richard Nixon's Checkers speech, in which he said, you won't have me to kick around anymore. And this is a document that was withheld by the Ford White House from the Senate investigators in the mid-1970s when Senator Frank Church was exploring and investigating what the CIA had done in Chile and what the orders of the CIA had been. This document has been kept secret all of these years, and it is one of those documents, Terry, which shows us the richness of this history. It gives us Richard Nixon, in his own words, elaborating on his feelings about a freely elected socialist government in Chile. It shows the imperial mindset of the President of the United States. And even more extraordinarily, you have him sitting there with his cabinet and all the other cabinet members, the Secretary of Defense, Melvin Laird, the Secretary of State, William Rogers, saying, yes, Allende has to go down. We have to bring him down. And when you have at the highest level of the U.S. government, people are freely talking about overthrowing a democratically elected government elsewhere, you have an extraordinarily important historical document.
What do these newly released documents reveal about what the U.S. government did to help bring about the coup in Chile to overthrow Allende?
Well, for all these years, the CIA has maintained that it played no, quote, direct, unquote, role. in overthrowing the Allende government in September of 1973. And for the most part, there are very few documents released now from that date period. We know that the CIA was monitoring coup plotting very, very closely, and that on September 8th, according to CIA intelligence reports, the United States did receive word that a coup was in motion. We know that immediately after the coup, the CIA set about embracing and supporting the violent military regime led by Augusto Pinochet. There is one extraordinary document that has been declassified on November 13th, and that is an intelligence report of a conversation with Augusto Pinochet in September of 1972, the full year before the coup took place. And it is a document that is going to help Chilean historians address the issue of when Pinochet's involvement in coup plotting began. In this document, he says to a U.S. intelligence source that he's having second thoughts about Allende, that Allende must be forced to step down or be eliminated. In other words, Pinochet showing his violent colors here, his violent stripes, suggesting that Allende be killed in order to facilitate a coup. At the very end of this document, most importantly, it says that Pinochet was in Panama in September of 1972, and that he met with U.S. Army officers who he had known from his days at the School of the Americas, and, quote, was told U.S. will support coup against Allende with whatever means necessary when the time comes. Now, this is a document which shows for the first time that the message was passed to the person who ended up leading the coup and to the person who established himself as dictator of Chile after the coup, that the United States would fully support his actions in this regard. And I believe that he and the rest of the Chilean military went into that coup knowing full well that the administration of the United States was fully behind them.
Does it say who led him to believe that, who told him that?
The names of these officers are not mentioned in the actual document, and the intelligence source of the actual report is blacked out. One of the problems with the documents that the CIA has declassified is that they are heavily censored, and it is continuing to wield a black magic marker in the name of national security. There's huge swaths of these records that are completely black and that are essentially covering up major actions that the CIA took that are extremely relevant to the historical record on Chile.
Do these documents offer new information on the connection between the CIA and General Manuel Contreras, who was the head of DINA, Pinochet's secret police?
The CIA sent a report up to Congress in September that laid out in great detail its relationship with General Manuel Contreras, who was considered the most ruthless violator of human rights in Chile. He was Pinochet's right-hand man of repression, if you will, leading the Chilean secret police. He was responsible for sending assassins to Washington, D.C. in September of 1976 to assassinate former Chilean ambassador Orlando Letelier. Letelier is an American associate, a 25-year-old New Jersey woman. Ronnie Moffitt was also murdered in that car bombing. We had hoped that the documents used in this report that was sent to Congress would be declassified on November 13th, documents that show the relationship between the CIA station chief in Santiago and Contreras, the payments that were made to Contreras when the CIA put him on the payroll, the intelligence information that they supposedly got from him, the minutes of their meetings with Manuel Contreras. But none of those documents were declassified. Those are important not only to the history of the U.S. role and responsibility in Chile, but to the current case against Contreras and against General Pinochet himself that the U.S. Justice Department is exploring on Pinochet's potential role as the intellectual author of the Letelier assassination. These documents have a historical value and they have a current legal value. We are hoping that they will eventually be declassified.
My guest is Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
This week, the Clinton administration completed its four-part release of secret documents about U.S. intervention in Chile. My guest, Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive, helped lead the campaign to declassify the documents. Is there any new information that these released documents offer about the murders of Americans Charles Horman and Frank Teruggi by the Chilean military shortly after the coup?
Many of the documents on Charles Horman were released last June 30th, but some new documents were released on November 13th about the case of the other American who was killed right after the coup, a young man named Frank Teruggi, who was working as a journalist in Chile at the time. The Chilean military came to his house several days after the coup, detained him and his roommate, took them to the National Stadium. His roommate was interrogated and eventually released, but Frank Teruggi was interrogated, tortured, and executed. His body later found in a public morgue. These new documents are very complicated. They show that U.S. intelligence, particularly the FBI and Defense Department intelligence, had received Frank Teruggi's name and address in Chile from German intelligence. A letter had been intercepted by somebody that the Germans were surveilling in Bonn. It was not a particularly important letter. It was simply a letter to somebody they were surveilling there who was publishing literature on various events around the world. And somebody had written to this individual saying, you know, I can't help you in terms of reporting on Chile, but there is a guy who was working as a journalist in Chile named Frank Teruggi. Here's his address. The FBI circulated the address and conducted an investigation in Teruggi here in the United States, did some other reporting on his supposedly leftist activities, labeled him a subversive in some of the documents. The question is whether these documents were passed to the Central Intelligence Agency and whether the Central Intelligence Agency passed them to the Chilean military at the point of the coup. This is a question that the Teruggi family certainly wants to see answered, and it is one of the remaining mysteries of the murder of this American in Chile.
What's the latest with Pinochet now? What's his legal status in Chile?
General Pinochet has been indicted in Argentina for a car bombing assassination of one of his military rivals, General Carlos Prats, and his wife in 1974. The Argentines are seeking his extradition. This was a very similar operation to the Letelier assassination. It took place 2 years before the car bombing here in Washington. Pinochet is now about to undergo some medical testing to determine whether he is mentally fit to stand trial. Almost all other obstacles to his actually appearing in a court of law and facing his victims have been removed by the Chilean courts, an extraordinary turn of events. General Pinochet is being tried on a specific set of disappearances, 14 disappearances that took place during something called the Caravan of Death, when he sent out one of his generals to go up and down Chile, removing political prisoners from jails and murdering them on the spot. 14 of those individuals are still disappeared, and General Pinochet is hopefully going to be tried on those cases. We know that the CIA has one very specific document that relates to those murders, dated in October of 1973, which has not yet been declassified. Hopefully, Chilean authorities can move to press the United States government to release that document and any other relevant document to the case against Pinochet, declassifying those documents or providing them to the Chilean courts so that they may be used as evidence against the general himself.
Have any of the classified documents that have yet been released, or will any, do you think, of the documents that you hope will be released, result in the prosecution of any United States citizens who were involved in covert actions in Chile or involved in the coup to overthrow Allende?
The CIA does not release the names of any of its agents. The names of many U.S. officials who were in Chile have been blacked out of these documents. It will be very, very difficult for anybody in Chile to actually bring a case, I think, a successful case against U.S. officials. But certainly, there is some accountability issues here. The United States was involved in promoting violence in Chile. In the case of Renee Schneider, was involved in trying to cover up a murder. I don't know. I think we have gone through a process of an accounting of the U.S. role in Chile, and eventually that process will shift to the issue of accountability. And in that phase, in the years to come, we may well see an effort by Chilean citizens to seek redress for what was done in their country by the United States.
There are documents you still hope will be released. What evidence do you have that these documents actually exist? What knowledge do you have of what they say?
We know about many documents because they have been referred to in previously published congressional or Senate reports or even CIA reports. A recent CIA report to Congress released in September contains multiple references to documents and events that just simply are non-existent in the records that have been released to date. You have to understand, though, that this is the end. This declassification of documents on November 13th marks the end of the Clinton administration's special Chile declassification project. In the future, we're going to have to take what we have learned, read through the documents very carefully, make a list of what we believe is not there, and seek legal remedy under the Freedom of Information Act or other mechanisms to get the rest of these documents declassified. It may be a long struggle. It took more than 30 years to get these documents declassified. Hopefully, it won't take another 30 years before we have the complete record in the public domain.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
It is a pleasure, as always, Terry.
Peter Kornbluh is a senior analyst at the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of The Change Before the Change, Everything You Need to Know to Stay Healthy in the Decade Before Menopause by Dr. Laura E. Corio and Linda G. Kahn. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, science fiction writer Ray Bradbury. This week he was awarded a National Book Foundation Medal for his contribution to American letters. Also, actress Glenn Close, she's starring in 102 Dalmatians. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.